I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Frederick Douglass is one of the most gifted and admired figures in American history. He was enslaved for the first 20 years of his life. By the time of his death in 1895, he had become an unparalleled public intellectual, a superstar speaker, the world's most photographed man, and a counselor to President Abraham Lincoln. David Blight's acclaimed biography of Frederick Douglass, the winner of the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for History, offers trenchant and sweeping insights into the particulars of Douglass's many gifts. David Blight joins me to talk about Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Our conversation was recorded earlier, so we can't take your calls and comments. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. My guest today is Professor David Blight of Yale University. He is the winner of the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for History for his expansive and acclaimed biography of Frederick Douglass. A highly respected Douglass scholar, David Blight is the annotator and editor of Douglass's second autobiography. This latest contribution to Douglass scholarship explores Douglass's amazing journey from enslavement on the eastern shore of Maryland to become one of the world's most transcendent and influential figures. The book is called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. David Blight joins me from a studio on the campus of Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take your calls and comments. Professor Blight, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be on in Baltimore and in the Maryland region.
And congratulations on your Pulitzer Prize. It's well-deserved. And speaking of Baltimore and the Maryland region, it plays a very central role in the life of Frederick Douglass. Tell us a little bit about where he was born in Talbot County and the first early years of his life.
Well, it's, of course, crucial, absolutely crucial in Douglass's life. He lived the first 20 years of his life as a slave in Maryland, about 11 of those years out on the Eastern Shore in a variety of tasks and roles of a slave, including a field hand in his teenage years. But about 9 of those years in Baltimore, back and forth a couple of times, and crucial, to say the least, was the fact that he became an urban slave, residing in Baltimore, residing amidst the very large free black population in Baltimore, involved in all kinds of urban jobs and tasks, working down in the docks, not easy labor, of course. But he became a very active participant in the street life, the church life, and the free black community life of Baltimore. But he was born out along a horseshoe bend in the Tuckahoe River on the eastern shore in Talbot County, just east of Easton. And he spent, well, his first 7 years there as a slave child, first at and around his grandmother Betsy's cabin right over on the Tuckahoe, then at the White House Plantation, which, of course, is still there. The Great White House is still there, owned by the Tillman family today, who have happily embraced Douglass's story and are more than willing to help the world learn that story now. But then he also lived, of course, in St. Michael's with his owner, Thomas Auld. He was hired out famously to a slave breaker overseer named Edward Covey, who lived really just up the road to the west. And then he lived on the Freeland farm for a year, not too far from there. But the Eastern Shore and Baltimore shaped Frederick Bailey, who became Frederick Douglass. His 20 years as a slave is extremely formative for him. It is also the time in which he comes by language, comes by literacy, begins to embrace language and words in ways that, ways in which words became the weapon of his life, the primary power of his life. So without Maryland, and particularly without Baltimore, we wouldn't even know about him.
You paint a picture of a young man in his teens, you know, approaching his 20th birthday, which was around about the time that he was able to escape slavery, mm-hmm. as a somewhat recalcitrant kid. It was interesting. He was by no means, you know, submissive in the way we think that slaves were forced to be. And you mentioned literacy. The wife of Thomas Auld, Sophia, mm-hmm. you say treated him somewhat like a mother.
Yes.
She acted somewhat like a mother and did, in fact, teach him how to read. Why was that? Why did she make that decision? And how did Douglas get away with being so headstrong?
Well, we can't know for sure why Sophia Auld chose to teach little Fred Bailey his alphabet and so on. He was only about 7, almost 8 when that happened. And for more than a year, he remembers her teaching him almost daily and reading with him out loud, learning the alphabet, reading the Bible out loud with him. Her husband, Hugh Auld, then came by one day, as Douglas tells it, and ordered her to stop teaching that kid how to read. It was too dangerous for a slave to learn to read. But it was too late. He had come by language. Then he comes by language again in books among his white playmates when he's about 10 and 11 in the streets of Baltimore. He meets these kids who are German and Irish immigrant kids. And they're all carrying this school reader with them called the Columbian Orator, compiled by Caleb Bingham in 1797. It was the second best-selling school reader in the United States after the McGuffey reader. And Douglas didn't take too long before he managed to pull together his pennies and go to a bookstore in Fells Point, and he bought a copy of the Columbian Orator, which became absolutely pivotal in his development of language, especially of oratorical language, because that book not only was a collection of classical and Enlightenment-era orations, but it had about a 20-page introduction that was a manual for oratory of how to do it, how to gesture, how to modulate your voice, and so on and so on. And this discovery of language, this discovery that he had a certain gift for it, that he pursued it, that he could gain some power with it over other people around him, only added to the problem of being a slave. And in the first autobiography, the narrative, he stops at one point while describing his youth and just says he came to a realization. And he says his white friends would ask him the same thing. Why are you a slave? And he would ask himself, why am I a slave? Why do they have the freedom of transit all over town? Why are they in a school and I'm not? And so on. Why do they get a real boyhood and I don't? And that recalcitrance, once he's a teenager in particular, became at times a kind of almost violent rebellion in him. And that is why one of the reasons Thomas Auld, his then owner, when he's back out on the Eastern Shore, sent him off for most of a year to this man, Edward Covey, who was known for handling disobedient slaves. And he beat the living dickens out of Douglas, according to Douglas's account, every week for months on end until he really broke him. Or Douglas says, you know, he was broken. He was made into this tool of the slave system. Until one day, at least in Douglas's telling of it, he rose up against Covey, took him on, they fought, and in Douglas's telling of it, and he is our only source for that, he got the best of Covey. He kicked his behind, if you like. And from that day forward, the rest of the months he was with him, Douglas tells us that Covey never laid another hand on him. Now, Douglas makes that into the literary pivot of his first autobiography and of the second, for good reason. It is a kind of a claiming of himself, regeneration through violence, which is a common thing in male narratives and memoirs. But It is the seizure of words, language, the ability to get on his feet and read out loud and then preach out loud that he's already doing as a teenager. And then his experience going to no less than four different churches in Baltimore, two primarily white churches, two primarily black churches, his exposure to different kinds of sermonic traditions, and his exposure, this is crucial as well, to an old black preacher in Baltimore whose name was Charles Lawson. Douglas called him sometimes Uncle Lawson or Father Lawson. This was a guy who drove a cart by day. He was a drayman to make a little bit of a living, but he was a Bible fanatic. And he had discovered this young Fred Bailey when Douglas was only maybe 13 or so, he got Douglas to sit with him and read for hours and hours and hours out loud the Bible, especially the Old Testament, because Lawson was not a very good reader, but this kid was. And so the way Douglas got language in his mind and in his head was primarily through reading and hearing the King James Version of the Bible.
Yeah, and that beautiful, beautiful capacity he had for language and for oratory.
It's the reason we know about him. It's the reason we remember him.
And he had an amazing escape. You mentioned he was in Baltimore. He met up with a guy who worked down at the docks in Fells Point and got a document that started his amazing escape. But he got out of enslavement, but lived as a fugitive under the threat of being recaptured for 9 years almost. I mean, this was that kind of pressure and that kind of stress had to be formative as well.
Oh, no question. He was 9 years a fugitive slave, living first in New Bedford, Massachusetts for 3 years, then Lynn, Massachusetts for several years with his then wife, Anna Marie, who followed him out of Baltimore and demonstrated the same bravery that Douglas did in escaping out of Baltimore. She was free. She was born free. Also, out on the eastern shore, right along the Tuckahoe, she was from Caroline County, just across the Tuckahoe. They met in Baltimore. But he lives in New Bedford and then, of course, Lynn, Massachusetts. And it was only when he went to England in 1845, with his new narrative in hand, this short autobiography that is now taught so widely across the world, it is only while he was in England in 1847, when some British friends, British abolitionist friends, raised the money, sufficient money, to offer to purchase his freedom from the Auld brothers, from Thomas and Hugh Auld. And they did. And there was a formal exchange of letters and papers. And Douglas was sold for the equivalent of about $711.
Yeah, 150 pounds sterling. Yeah.
It's 150 pounds sterling, and I love to remember that number, and so did he, because it always reminds us that what slavery was about, in great part, was putting a price on people, making people property and putting a price on it. And that was his price, and they purchased his freedom. He did not return to the U.S. until the spring of 1847, but he had formal free papers in his hands. So by 1847, he was legally free and no longer had to live with this cloud of being a fugitive slave.
And you write about how his time abroad certainly informed his view of the United States and his place in the country. And you talk about how he channeled his anger about being enslaved, and he needed that distance, physical distance from America in order to do that.
Well, I love that question, Tom, because it's crucial to understand these pivots in Douglas's life. If people know Douglas at all, they tend to know the young, heroic Douglas who escapes slavery, becomes the famous orator, and so on and so forth. But they don't necessarily know the depth of these turning points in his life, the struggle, the incredible difficulty that he had adapting to the life he chose. And he did have a flowering, to say the least, in Ireland, Scotland, and England for about 18 months. In 1845 to 47, he toured all over the British Isles. The British Reform Movement, the abolitionist, made an absolute heroic figure out of him. People flocked to see him and hear him. And they loved him, by and large. And he did not experience anything like the racism there that he had already experienced and would again back in the U.S. And he comes back when he chooses to finally come back and come back to his family, growing family. He came back a very angry young man. He now had this experience of realizing there is a world out there that is not defined in every way by the racist strictures that the United States was. All that, I mean, it doesn't mean there wasn't racism in the British Isles. There was. And there were minstrel troops and all the rest. But he returns a very angry young guy, saying things like, "I have no country. I have no patriotism. My country rejects me and I reject it." And he came back ready for the lecture circuit in 1847, where he would begin to blister not only the slave system, but the country itself.
And Professor, I want to ask you to pause there. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, I want to talk about this schism within the abolitionist movement. My guest is David Blight. He's a professor of history at Yale University and the director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale. His latest book won the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for History. It's called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. We'll have more with David Blight after a quick break. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take your calls and comments today. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Professor David Blight of Yale University. We're talking about his latest book. It is a gem. It won the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for History. It's called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take your calls and comments. So, David Blight, before we took the break there, we started talking about this schism that you write about in the abolitionist community, the two camps. One believed in what they called moral suasion, mm-hmm. and the others were convinced that political action was the way to achieve the end of slavery. So describe the tension between those two camps.
Sure. That's the course Douglass is on in the late 1840s, early 1850s, after he returned from England. He was very close to William Lloyd Garrison, and the Massachusetts abolitionist amidst whom he sort of learned his trade. But he was growing into a political animal, a political mind. He was no longer satisfied with the idea that you would only end slavery in this country by affecting the hearts and minds of people on a spiritual level. He grew to realize that the power behind slavery was political, and it had to be attacked on that level. He also was no longer a full supporter of Garrison's style of pacifism, or what then was called non-resistance. So he begins to move toward the possible uses of violence. He begins to warm up to the Free Soil Party, then the Liberty Party. These were the early anti-slavery political parties. And eventually, by 1854, even the Republican Party after it was born. It's a very important turning point in Douglass's life, in part for personal reasons as well, because he's now gone on his own. Moved out to Rochester, New York in late 1847. He founds his own newspaper called the North Star. And he tries to make it with his own printing press, his own hired printer, and his own subscription list as an anti-slavery newspaper editor. And he did become an extraordinary journalist, and for 16 years he would edit this paper. The trouble was, it was never financially viable, as many abolitionist papers weren't. And he needed the help of Gerrit Smith, upstate New York, very wealthy abolitionist who helped underwrite Douglass's paper and keep it alive. And then he needed the help of a very important friend he made in England. Her name was Julia Griffiths. He met her in 1846 in England. We don't know exactly the nature of their relationship. What we do know is she came to America in 48 and then went back and came back in 49, stayed for 6 years out in Rochester, became Douglass's assistant editor on the newspaper, became his principal fundraiser. She was like the manager and organizer of his newspaper enterprise, and really indeed was his editor. So she also, though, lived in the Douglass home, and it became a source of scandal. The Garrisonians back in Massachusetts, and Garrison himself, angry that Douglass had abandoned them, gone off on his own, gone his own ideological route, accused Douglass of having an affair with this English woman in his own home, under the eyes of his own family and his own wife. Now, Douglass and Julia both, of course, denied it vehemently, but it caused a terrible breakup, personal and public, between Douglass, Garrison, and the Garrisonian abolitionist. And Douglass, in most ways, never really made up with Garrison in the ensuing 2.5 decades.
Yeah, and the breakup occurred with Garrison, but it did not occur, we should mention, with his wife, Anna. And Julia was not the only relationship, professional relationship, that Douglass had. He had a very complicated personal life. She was by no means the only woman in his circle with whom he worked. And Anna had a very particular place in his orbit as well, but not involved at all with his professional life.
That's correct, Tom. And I try very hard in this biography to develop Anna Murray Douglass's story. It's not simple because she, of course, remained almost entirely illiterate. She certainly could count. She kept account books. But she never became literate, and she never really traveled with Douglass. And Douglass was a constant traveler, constantly out on the lecture circuit. She was not part of his public presence. But she made a home, which is what, of course, most women in the 19th century did. She made a home. She was the mother of their 5 children. The fifth, Annie, Anna's namesake, died at age 11 in 1860 in a diphtheria epidemic. But she raised these other 4 children in the 1840s and 1850s. She made that home a refuge for this struggling, at times deeply insecure, directionless, brilliant young man. Without Anna, Douglass doesn't survive. But at the same time, he grew into this world-class intellectual, this world-class writer, this thinker, this man always becoming. And he did develop deep and important friendships with at least 2 women. Well, he had friendships with lots of women. He had the 2 relationships that we know of, Julia Griffiths and the second, and I'll try to make it quick, although she is woven throughout many chapters of the book. Her name was Ottilie Assing. She was German, German 48er, as they were called, deeply influenced by the democratic revolutions in Europe in 1848. She was the daughter of poets. She was extremely well-educated and well-read, and she came to America in about 1853 as a journalist. She wrote for a German journal called Der Morgenblatt. And in 1855, she read Douglass's second autobiography, My Bondage and My Freedom, which is his long-form masterpiece. And she was knocked out of her shoes by that book. She went out to Rochester, literally knocked on the door, asked to interview Douglass, and then asked if she could do a German translation of that book, which she did within 2 years or 3 years, and in effect tried never to leave, in a sense, his life. And for about 22 or 23 years, they sustained a relationship, friendship, connection. She living in Hoboken, New Jersey, where there was a circle of German emigres, and he, of course, out in Rochester, and then eventually in Washington, D.C. And in that particular case, though we can't know for certain, it probably was a sexual relationship, although there are differences of opinion among Douglas scholars. She is sometimes referred to as a friend of the family, and she did become friends with Douglas's adult children. But about 99% of what we know about that relationship comes only from Assing, from the letters she wrote to her sister back in Europe. The letters Douglas wrote to her, she burned or destroyed in some way. And there's very little in Douglas's writing, almost nothing, of a personal nature about his relationship with Assing.
And then later on, when he's 66 years old, that's about 11 years before he dies, right, he marries a white woman.
Yes.
Anna was no longer in the picture.
Right.
A woman named Helen Pitts. And this was a huge thing. I mean, I guess they kept it quiet for a little while, but this is an interracial marriage,
right,
in the late 1800s,
right,
by a very famous black intellectual. That was a groundbreaking, precedent busting move in and of itself.
It's the most scandalous marriage of 19th century America, bar none. Anna died after a series of strokes and bad health in 1882 when Douglas was living at Cedar Hill, this big house that he managed to purchase in the late 1870s up in Anacostia in the District of Columbia, with a loan, by the way, of about $6,000 from a black friend in Philadelphia named Robert Purvis. But when Anna died, Douglas came apart. He really did. He went off to Poland Springs, Maine, a resort, by himself for about a month to 6 weeks, and just chilled out. Wrote some letters, though, thankfully, some beautiful letters back and forth with his daughter and two of his sons. But then, within about a year and a half of Anna's death, he married Helen Pitts, as you just said. She was 46, he was 66. She was very well educated, Mount Holyoke College graduate. She grew up in Western New York in an abolitionist family. She had served in a contraband camp as a nurse and a teacher during the war. She had good abolitionist credentials. And he had hired her as one of the clerks in the Recorder of Deeds office in Washington, D.C., where he was, one of his three federal appointments was as Recorder of Deeds. And Helen worked in a desk almost exactly next to his daughter Rosetta, who was another one of the clerks, and they were almost the same age. Now, when Douglas got married to Helen, they kept it a total secret until the day they chose to get married. And they were married in the parlor of a black minister named Francis Grimke, who obviously kept the secret. But that afternoon, Rosetta, Douglas's daughter, sitting at her desk, gets visited by a reporter who says, "Did you realize your father just bought a marriage license up the hall here?" Because they were in the city hall. And that's how Rosetta found out that her father had just been married. The children, who are now all adults and have their own families and you know, are part of this huge extended family that Douglas was the patriarch of, they never really took well to Helen for a whole variety of reasons. But by all accounts, and I don't think there's any question about this, this marriage was a very good marriage through the last 11 years of Douglas's life. Helen was now in quite a public wife. She traveled with Douglas, not everywhere, but she often traveled with him, and they even did an 11-month tour of Europe and of the Mediterranean together in 1866 1886 in 1887. But the furor over that marriage went on for months in the press. He was attacked by blacks, by whites, all over the place. He was also defended by some people. But here was the most famous black man in the world marrying a white woman 20 years younger. And as you said, this was the 1880s. I mean, that would even be big news and to some people scandalous today, I suppose.
Sure.
But in the 1880s, you can bet it was scandalous.
Just got a couple minutes before we need to take a break, but sure. I do want you to talk about the contradictory roles you write about that Douglas played as both a patriarch of this big family, but he was kind of an absent, he was an absent father because, as you mentioned, he was just on the road constantly giving lectures. So in a way, he was, we write about he was kind of a guest in his own house. So that relationship with his children, and of course he had great tragedy. You mentioned one of the children who was who died at age 11. He lost 10 grandchildren as well.
Exactly.
But talk about this notion of being a guest in his own house.
Well, especially in the early years, when Douglas is out on the lecture circuit for months at a time, he would come home, and in the testimonies and narratives that were written by their daughter Rosetta and even by two of the sons, they describe their father's coming home from these lecture trips as homecomings, like he was the special guest, and Anna would make a special dinner. He was gone a great deal. I think, call him an absent father at times, although it was a common thing for public men in the 19th century, in the age of, you know, railroad and stagecoach travel, to be gone long periods of time. The same would be true of congressmen and certainly of other kinds of public political figures. But on the other side of that, he had an adoring relationship with his children. When they were children and went and into adulthood. But after the war, in the 1870s, 80s, and on, he's the patriarch of a huge extended family. Four surviving adult children, 21 grandchildren, at least three fictive siblings that adopted him, and he adopted them from slavery days, and always a variety of other hangers-on who were around Douglas. And he had a constant problem of running funerals out of his home in Washington because, as you just said, about 10 of those 21 grandchildren died in infancy or died in their childhood or teenage years. It was just, in fact, one time the four of them died in an epidemic in 1 month.
Yeah.
So this was a huge brood of people, and here's the bottom line of it. They were almost all financially dependent upon him.
Yeah, you're right about how they're always asking him for money. These kinds of personal pressures, and then he still produced the body of work that he produced. It's remarkable. David Blight is a professor of history at Yale University. The book is called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. It's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. We'll have more with David Blight on the remarkable life of Frederick Douglass and this remarkable book after a quick break. A reminder that our conversation was pre-recorded, so we are not able to take your calls and emails today. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is David Blight, and we're talking about his extensive, almost granular look at the life and influence of one of history's most consequential figures, Frederick Douglass. Began life in 1818 as an enslaved child on the eastern shore of Maryland, and by the time he died in 1895, he had become the world's most photographed man, an author and a speaker whose work changed the trajectory of history in the United States and around the world. The book is called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. David Blight is a professor of history at Yale University and a Douglass Scholar of long standing. This latest book was the winner of the 2019 Pulitzer Prize in History. David Blight joins us for the hour from the campus of Yale in New Haven, Connecticut, where he is on the faculty. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take your calls and comments. So, David Blight, you write about the great Jewish scholar Abraham Heschel and his comment about what a prophet was. Yeah. And Heschel calls them people who experience moments that defy our understanding. He's neither a singing saint nor a moralizing poet, but an assaulter of the mind. Hmm. I love that notion. How, in what ways did Douglass assault the minds of his 19th century fellows? Yeah.
Gosh, thanks for reading that passage. I love that passage. I often read that passage, in fact, in my public book talks. Heschel was a mid-20th century theologian who wrote many, many books, but he particularly wrote a huge tome called The Prophets. And Heschel was crucial to me, as well as a number of other theologians, in helping me become comfortable even using that term prophet.
And we should also say, by the way, that Heschel was a big colleague of Martin Luther King in the civil rights movement in the 1960s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the civil rights. He was used in fact, himself participated in the civil rights movement. But Heschel helps one understand, and he's not alone here. I read a lot of other Old Testament scholars in particular, like Robert Alter and Walter Brueggemann and others, who help us understand that what a prophet is not a person who just predicts things by any means. If the model is the Hebrew prophets, the prophets of the Old Testament, and their comparisons over time, a prophet is that person who can somehow, under tremendous crises and pressure and pivots in history, or catastrophic events, or even victorious events, can find the words. They're the person who can find the language to explain to us what is happening where most of the rest of us cannot find that language. And Douglass is one of those figures. Anyone who sits with Douglass, reads the narrative, may read Bondage and Freedom, or may read some of the great speeches, is aware of this. You read Douglass and suddenly there's a recognition, there's a sentence, there's a metaphor, there's a whole paragraph that just blasts you between the eyes, wakes you up, makes you stand up and realize, oh my God, look at that irony, look at that metaphor, look at that contrast, look at how he's explaining our contradictions. A prophet challenges us to rise above ourselves, to become what we say we are, to try to solve and dissolve our hypocrisies of being human. Prophets are explainers of the human condition. Douglass was that person. The more and more I read Abraham Heschel and others, I began to realize, that's what Douglass does. That's Douglass. There's a point at which Heschel also says the prophet is that person who finds the words to shatter us. And that is what they do. A prophet, makes us hurt. A prophet is not what we always want to hear. In fact, it's usually what we don't want to hear. But we somehow know we should. Now, that doesn't make him accurate about everything by any means. It doesn't make him prescient of everything by any means. It's not about prediction. It's about the capacity to find words to explain our condition. And in Douglass's case, of course, that condition was slavery, the movement to destroy slavery, the Armageddon of the Civil War, the transformations that war brought in a total bloodbath, the tremendous challenges of Reconstruction, and then the tremendous challenges of what happened in the early Jim Crow era and the early era of lynching, all of which he saw, all of which he experienced, and all of which he left as many words to explain it as anybody in the 19th century.
David Blight, the book is called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We have pre-recorded our conversation, so we can't take your calls and comments today. You mentioned the incredibly grueling schedule of lectures that Douglass had all of his life. As a matter of fact, the scene that you write on the day of Douglass's death is very poignant. He's 77 years old. He's preparing to go to give a speech that night And as the carriage pulls up to take him to a black church to give this lecture, he falls dead of a heart attack. So it was literally right to the last moments of his life he was involved in the lecture circuit.
Yes.
And you, one of the great joys of this book is the trenchant analysis that you give of so many of his speeches. Let me ask you about one in particular.
Sure.
It's called Self-Made Men.
And
it's about self-reliance. This is a speech that he gave many times over a 30-year period.
Right.
What is it about speeches like this that you know that impress you so mightily about Douglass's incredible oratorical gift?
Sure. Well, first of all, his speech has so impressed people in the 19th century, and people flocked to see Douglass, hear Douglass. In fact, I try to show in the book that, you know, hearing a Douglass speech became a kind of an American phenomenon. You just wanted to do it, even if you didn't like him, even if you didn't agree with him. Because he had such a voice, such a capacity with language. He was such a great storyteller, and so much of that storytelling power came from how steeped he was in Old Testament storytelling and Old Testament theology. I don't spend a lot of time in this book trying to explain Douglass's actual religious faith. I mean, he certainly had religious faith. It changed over time. My concerns are mostly how the Bible, its stories, its metaphors became the source of his language and a source for his own storytelling. But Self-Made Man is a speech that we believe he first gave even before the war in 1859, but it particularly became a popular speech out on the circuit in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. He would carry it with him as a text out on the road on these wintertime lecture tours he would do year after year after year, Chautauqua Circuit and all of that, where he would get about $100, sometimes $150 a pop. He did this for money, make no mistake, and his extended family needed it. But that Self-Made Man speech was, on the one hand, all about this deeply, deeply American myth, this great story about how in America you could remake yourself. You could convince, you could redefine yourself from one age to another, from one period of your life to another. He had many favorite models for this. For one thing, he loved Ralph Waldo Emerson's famous essay called Self-Reliance. He read Emerson carefully. He quotes Emerson in that speech. He also, of course, used Lincoln as a classic sort of log cabin to White House story. And he was himself his own model for this story. He's the nobody slave who comes by education, by his own will and some good fortune, and becomes somebody. Did he ever? On the other hand, that speech is not just this bromide that some people have made it into, and it is not just a piece of self-reliance as some right-wingers, some libertarians today want to make it into, and they have used Douglass to do this. It is also an analysis of the human will, of the human spirit, of the idea of ambition, of the idea of indeed making yourself into something against obstacles and you know, climbing mountains as an individual. And I did an analysis of that speech. I mean, I don't do it too much in the text of the book, but there's a long footnote where I actually went through and did a counting of the people in history that he invokes the most in that speech. It's a long speech, and he's name-dropping all kinds of people in that speech. And of course, the Bible came out first. And more mentions of the Bible and biblical figures than anything else. Then came Shakespeare. Douglass was a tremendous fan of Shakespeare, which was a common thing in the 19th century. He owned three complete works of Shakespeare. Then came Lincoln. And then came Robert Burns. He became a huge fan of the English and Scottish romantic poets. And then there are single or double mentions of all sorts of other people in that book. I'm sorry, that speech. But popular audiences loved that speech because, you know, is there a deeper American story that people want to believe in, even though they know it's against the odds, that you can somehow next year have a better year? You can somehow next month remake what you did this month. If you had a bad crop season, you can have a better crop season. You know, there's always that next chance. There's that next horizon. And Americans have always needed to believe in that. And who didn't need to believe in that if you were born a slave?
Yeah, and Ronald Reagan, it's mourning in America.
Mourning in America.
This is the same kind of thing.
We have used and misused this mythology so many times, but Douglass laid down one of the most interesting and powerful analyses of that idea that we are self-makers and remakers of ourselves in this country. Whether that's our best side or not is another question.
And of course,
in the 19th century, nobody could avoid facing that myth.
And Douglass's own understanding of the complexities of slavery, for example, evolved, as you write about. The beginning of the Civil War, he was very critical of Lincoln. Eventually, they became quite close. And America is still struggling with the stain of slavery. You write about the Republicans in the aftermath of the war trying to figure out the issues of how to define citizenship and what to do with the Confederate war debts and the sort of practicality of Reconstruction. But the presidential campaign this year has a conversation about reparations.
Yes.
How do you think, as a scholar of slavery and as a scholar of Douglass, we just have a couple minutes left here, how do you think the discussion about reparations should be framed in 2019?
Sure. Well, first of all, Tom, it shows that the legacies of Reconstruction are never over, that Reconstruction after the Civil War, in effect, never ended. The fact that we continue to have that debate, and a debate over so many other things like federalism, like the nature of the 14th Amendment, like the nature of birthright citizenship, like the nature of equality before law.
All like, things that Douglass dealt with.
All things. Take voting rights, for God's sake. I mean,
Women's suffrage.
Exactly.
Sure.
I mean, Douglass's life is the lens through which to see all of those issues in the 19th century and therefore to see why they're still with us. I'll just say this about reparations. If indeed it is ever to come, if it is to come out of this next political season, I frankly doubt it, but if it is, it's got to come in some structured policy. It's got to come out of a policy initiative that develops a consensus, that develops some kind of majority belief that it's the right thing to do, that it's an effective thing to do, and that it's a fair thing to do. That is not going to be easy. But it is possible to construct policy, whether it's about education, or policy about inherited wealth, or policy about banking, or policy about access to public education and how much to pay for it. There are all kinds of possibilities in the policy realm that may look like, sound like, walk like reparations if the political culture can produce it. The trouble with the issue, of course, is that it's a classic wedge issue. Classic wedge issue.
Yeah.
And particularly for the right in America, and who will just pillory anybody who wants to come out in favor.
And will be undoubtedly used as such, to be sure. David Blight, his assiduously researched and really insightful biography of the great Frederick Douglass, won the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for History. It's called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. It's published by Simon & Schuster. David Blight, I really enjoyed talking to you and really enjoyed reading your book. Thanks so much.
The pleasure was all mine, Tom. Thanks so much for having me on, and hello to Baltimore and to Maryland.
That's it for us today. I'm Tom Hall. You can subscribe to the Midday Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and you can visit our website, wypr.org/midday, to catch shows that you may have missed or shows you'd like to hear again. To follow us on Twitter, we're at @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, I'm at @TomHallWYPR. To send us your thoughts about our show on email, the address is midday@wypr.org. On behalf of the entire Midday team, thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.